The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Our first article is from Drama in Real Life, Rock Bottom. A hiker somehow survived being pinned in a creek under a 700-pound boulder. Then the water started to rise. By Eric Raskin. When Joanna Roop heard a deep rumble overlaid with thunderous crashes, a sick feeling invaded the pit of her stomach. The horrible clatter of rocks and boulders stampeding down the hillside was emanating from the spot where her husband, Kel Morris, had been standing a minute earlier. The pair, both 61 years old, had been hiking along Godwin Creek in Seward, Alaska, looking for a place to cross the water and route to their intended destination, Godwin Glacier. They had split up, and Morris had scaled some rocky terrain against the cliff while Roop walked downstream a bit. She'd made a mental note earlier of a potential crossing and was making her way back there when she heard the landslide about 100 yards behind her. She ran as fast as she could, but she felt as if she was moving in slow motion. And to an extent, she was. Each step had to be deliberate as she traversed the rocks. "Kel!" she hollered. "Kel!" She heard no reply over the rushing water. Roop was all but certain that her husband was gone, buried beneath a pile of rocks. But there he was, along the edge of the water, with his distinctive brown fedora and a blue pack. Thank God! Then Roop realized she could only see him from the shoulder blades up. Most of the rest of his body was pinned under a massive boulder shaped like a half moon. Morris lay on his stomach, fully conscious, his face just barely out of the creek water. "He's got to be crushed under there," Roop thought. But Morris was talking and did not seem to be in pain, even though his left boot pointed out from under the rock and up to the sky at a sickening angle. She assumed that his leg had been crushed. Morris could move his right leg and his arms and could breathe fine. What he couldn't do was turn his head and see the enormity of the boulder that had trapped him. "Just move it, Joe," he called out. The boulder, which was later determined to weigh about 700 pounds, was far too big for Roop to move on her own. Nevertheless, she squatted, reached under it from the side, and tried to lift. The massive rock wouldn't budge. Morris propped himself up on his elbows and brought his right knee up while Roop gripped the stone. Working in unison, him pushing up from underneath, her from the side, they managed to shift it ever so slightly, but that was the best they could do. Roop took out her cell phone. But in this remote area, there was no signal at all. With no immediate way to get help, she searched the area for a long, skinny rock she could slide underneath the boulder and leverage it enough to give Morris room to crawl out. But she couldn't find the tool she needed. She also worried that if the boulder shifted, it might crush him. Morris began to shiver in the 35-degree water. "Stop, Joe," he said. "Go try to get help." He reached into his pocket and pulled out his phone. "Here, now you've got two phones. Go as far as you have to go until you get a signal." Roop didn't want to leave her husband, but she knew she had no choice. And somehow, she kept her sense of humor. "Don't go anywhere," she told Morris as she set off. Kel Morris and Joe Roop met as middle-aged divorcees and had one of those Brady Bunch-like marriages. He had two grown daughters, she had two grown sons. A couple of years after they married, they were living in Kootenai, Idaho, a small city about 60 miles from the Canadian border, where they retired early and started building two houses with the intention of making rental income on them. "But we both retired too early," Morris says. "Our pensions were being eaten up by inflation. We got the first house about half built, and then we started running out of money." In 2024, Roop, who had been an Alaska state trooper before she retired, was catching up with an old friend in Seward and lamenting that she needed to go back to work. The friend mentioned that the local police department needed people. Before they knew it, Roop and Morris moved to Alaska, where Roop joined the police department and Morris, who'd had an assortment of jobs over the years ranging from pipe fitter to ski instructor, found work as a foreman with a marine engineering company. The plan was to return to Idaho regularly to keep working on the houses until they could retire. Morris and Roop had always loved hiking, and they couldn't resist the lure of Alaska's natural beauty. This past May 24, Saturday of Memorial Day weekend, they wanted to avoid the holiday crowds on the Kenai Peninsula, an area containing part of Seward that juts out from the coast of south-central Alaska. Instead, they decided to hike to the Godwin Glacier via an undeveloped, isolated trail. They would follow Fourth of July Creek up to Godwin Creek, which is lined with boulders deposited by the glacier. They loaded their backpacks with what they'd need for the day: snacks, water, dry clothes. The temperature was just under 50 degrees when they left home around 8 a.m. and was forecast to rise to 55, one of the warmest days of the year so far in Seward. "If we make it to the glacier, great. But if we don't, we don't," Morris said as they set out. "We'll have a great day out either way." They walked for a couple of miles, followed some fresh moose and bear tracks, then took a break a little before 11 a.m. to watch a newborn mountain goat and its mama. "It's not even up and walking yet," Roop whispered. When they got moving again, the creek narrowed and the current became faster. Morris and Roop went in separate directions in search of a safe place to cross. Morris didn't want to walk below some unstable-looking boulders, so he made his way up the steep canyon, getting high enough to walk above them. Just as he feared, the boulders were loose. Morris was directly above them when they started to slide down the slope. The smaller rocks he was walking on gave way as well. "I didn't see anything," he recalls. "I have no visual memory at all, but the sound will probably be with me forever." It all happened in an instant. Morris tumbled about 20 feet and landed face down in the water. The boulder that came down behind him surely would have crushed him if not for the fact that several other large rocks had landed right beside him and absorbed most of the impact of that big daddy. Lying in the creek, Morris did a quick self-assessment. "Yes, I'm alive. Yes, I have feeling in my limbs, but I'm stuck. I can't move my left leg at all, and I'm pinned down under something. Help! Help!" he yelled. Minutes later, Roop found him. Now, fearing that her husband didn't have long to live, Roop didn't want to leave him alone, but she was desperate to call for help. She walked about 300 yards to the first curve in the creek, where she had a decent line of sight down the valley. She tried her phone. To her amazement, the 911 call went through. Roop knew the dispatcher who answered. "Evan, it's Officer Roop. Cal is stuck in the river under a big boulder with his leg crushed. I need a helicopter, and I need it now." While Roop made her way back to her husband, 22-year-old Sam Paperman was driving home from a morning shift leading dog sled tours across the local glaciers for Turning Heads Kennel. His employers, Iditarod veterans Sarah Stokey and Travis Beals, also own Seward Helicopter Tours, and Paperman is a volunteer with the neighboring Bear Creek Fire Department. He was the right person in the right place at the right time when the dispatch notification from the Seward Fire Department hit his phone. "Please respond to a search and rescue on a male individual who is trapped under a boulder in the creek." Paperman had hiked the rugged Godwin Creek plenty of times and knew that it was nearly impossible to access by truck or even all-terrain vehicle. So he called the airport manager at Seward Helicopter Tours and got approval to turn one of their choppers into a rescue vehicle for the day. Then he called the Seward Fire Department. "We have two helicopters," Paperman said. We can push all of our tours to one of them, and the other one is ready to go. A few minutes later, Paperman and pilot Neo Martinson were airborne. Cal Morris had never feared death, but as he lay there alone, he wondered how painful it would be to meet his end through hypothermia. The water wasn't just freezing. It was also rapidly rising. On this relatively warm, cloudless day, the glacier was melting at a higher rate than normal. Morris began shivering harder, but he kept calm, placed his hands on the creek floor, and pushed up, keeping his bearded face out of the water until Roop returned. "They're coming," she told Morris. "I told them we need a helicopter. They're on their way." At 12:09 p.m., 12 minutes after the call was dispatched, Seward Fire Department Chief Clinton Kreitz set up an incident command post at the Seward Marine Industrial Center quarry, about 2 miles downstream from Morris and Roop. That was the closest the rescue trucks could get. Kreitz sent rescue workers by ATV, but on this extremely rocky terrain, it would be slow going. The Seward Helicopter Tours chopper arrived when the ATVs were still at least 45 minutes out. Paperman saw Roop down below, waving her arms. There was no level surface to set the helicopter down, so Martinson brought one skid to rest on the ground, the other hovering over the water, and Paperman climbed out. The chopper headed back to the command post to pick up more men and supplies. In the meantime, Roop and Paperman, who had no medical gear or equipment, did what they could, which wasn't much. "Let's wedge a piece of driftwood under the boulder to try to relieve a bit of pressure," Paperman said. Working together, they tipped the 700-pound stone ever so slightly, causing it to reposition on Morris's left thigh. It was the most pain he'd ever felt. He was sure his femur was about to snap. Paperman and Roop were in some pain of their own as they strained to stop the boulder from shifting any more. The frigid water was soaking through their boots. Roop's fingers ached from trying to hold the boulder steady. All they could do was wait for reinforcements. Jason Harrington, a 27-year-old full-timer with the Seward Fire Department, was enjoying hamburgers on the grill with several other firefighters that picture-perfect late spring day when the call came in that a man was trapped under a boulder in Godwin Creek. The barbecue was put on hold. Harrington and his fellow rescue workers rushed to the incident command post. The tour helicopter could fit 3 rescuers at a time. Harrington was in the first group that Martinson flew to Morris, Roop, and Paperman. About 15 minutes after Paperman had arrived on the scene, the chopper hovered again with one skid on the ground, and Harrington and 2 other firefighters hopped out. Harrington took charge as the incident commander. "Okay, we have a few guys here now. Let's get this thing off Kel," Roop said. But Harrington's training and experience led him to a different approach. He saw a conscious, stable victim in a boulder field where everything had the potential to shift as the water rose. "We're going to need more manpower," he said. "If they tried to lift the rock and failed, they risk setting it down on Morris, particularly if the smaller rocks underneath it shifted. One wrong move, and he could be crushed to death." Harrington assessed Morris. Hypothermia was clearly setting in. The fallen hiker was conscious, but his verbal responses were getting slower, and his speech was becoming slurred. They were racing against the clock. But Harrington believed they had time for the helicopter to bring in another 3 rescuers and more equipment. While they waited, one of the rescuers examined Morris's twisted boot. "Can you wiggle the toes on your left foot?" he asked as he squeezed the toe of the boot. "Yeah, I'm wiggling them right now," Morris responded. The boot wasn't moving. The rescue workers shook their heads. "This guy's going to lose his leg." By the time the helicopter returned, Morris had been in the creek for nearly 3 hours. He slipped in and out of consciousness as hypothermia set in. Stay with me, Rupe urged her husband as she held his head above the rushing water. His dropping body temperature was a greater threat than drowning, but all the factors were adding up. We're running out of time, Harrington told his crew. We have to hurry up and get him out of here. The rescuers wedged two pneumatic airbags, often used to dislodge heavy objects in car crashes, under the boulder and inflated them, helping stabilize everything and protect Morris if the boulder slipped. The time had come to apply some brute force. Four men gripped the edges of the 700-pounder and, on the count of three, lifted it as high as they could on one side. Not much, just an inch or so in the air. Hold it steady, Harrington yelled. Three smaller rocks pinned down Morris's left leg, so two rescuers reached in and moved them. Rupe's job was to pull Morris out, but when the moment arrived, she was too exhausted to drag him against the flow of the creek. She moved him a bit, but now, if the rescuers lost their grip on the boulder, it would probably cut his legs off at the thigh. I need help, Rupe called out. One of the firefighters moving the smaller rocks grabbed Morris under the armpits, and while the other men kept the giant boulder elevated, pulled him out. After 3 hours trapped under the rock, Morris was free. The rescuers thought they needed to tend to his mangled left leg, but quickly realized that his boot hadn't been on his foot. It had come off in the fall, twisted around and filled with water, which had made it feel as if there was a foot inside it. Far from being horribly twisted and mangled, Morris's leg had suffered only a few scratches. He wasn't out of danger yet, though. The team had to warm him up. The first step was getting him out of his wet clothes. Much to Morris's dismay, they cut him out of one of his better pairs of hiking pants. I have his long johns and dry clothes in my bag, Rupe said. They put them on him, then added thermal blankets, a sleeping bag, and a full-body vacuum splint, which wrapped around Morris's body and immobilized him. As his temperature rose, he became more alert, and his pulse and heart rate improved. It took about another hour before a 176-wing Alaska Air National Guard Pararescue Squadron helicopter, which was equipped to airlift Morris, arrived. He was then carried in a basket across Resurrection Bay to Providence Seward Medical Center, where he spent 2 nights. The hospital stay was purely a precaution. Morris was, somehow, largely unscathed. He had a nasty bruise on one shoulder and minor scratches all over, but that was about it. For him to have no significant injuries, Harrington says, that was shocking, in a good way. You wouldn't normally think of a man who gets caught in a rock slide, falls 20 feet, and lands face down in a creek under a boulder as lucky. But in a number of ways, Kel Morris was. If he'd banged his head on a hard surface on the way down, if the boulder hadn't landed just so on a scattering of other rocks, if Rupe hadn't been able to get a cell signal so quickly, if Sam Paperman and his helicopter hadn't been available to ferry the firefighters quickly to the scene, every star aligned in this case, Fire Chief Kreitz reflects. Morris and Rupe believe it was more than that. I don't feel like luck had anything to do with it, Rupe says. I feel like God's plan had everything to do with it. Morris was back to work 3 days after the accident, and he and Rupe planned to keep their busy schedule of hiking, backcountry skiing, and other outdoor adventures. We are definitely going to get to that glacier, Morris says. There's no way that thing's going to get the best of us. But probably we won't go up the creek. We know some folks who can get us there by helicopter. That was Rock Bottom by Eric Raskin. Our next article is a shorter, lighter piece. Secret Santa Saves the Day. A Stranger Keeps the Christmas Spirit Alive for a Little Girl by Caroline Fanning. It was 1 a.m. on Christmas morning, but for Marissa Shoemaker, it was still Christmas Eve. Like so many other parents, she had holiday magic to make. For weeks, her 4-year-old daughter, Aubrey, had been asking for one thing only for Christmas, a real piano keyboard, not just some dinky one made for little kids. Now that Aubrey was asleep, Shoemaker pulled the box from its hiding spot in their home in Bel Air, Maryland, ready to unveil the 61-key keyboard with full-size keys, perfect for serious beginners like Aubrey. Shoemaker figured she'd assemble the stand and bench and set it all up so it would be ready to play when Aubrey woke up and discovered her surprise. But when she opened the box, only the stand and bench were inside. No keyboard. Panic overtook her as she realized what she hadn't noticed before. The keyboard was sold separately. The night before, mother and daughter had watched the movie The Santa Claus. At one point, two of the main characters talk about the gifts they desperately wanted when they were kids but never received, which made them doubt the existence of Santa. "That scene immediately played in my mind," says Shoemaker. She recalled how happy she was as a little girl about Aubrey's age when she got her first guitar as a gift. What would Aubrey think when she came downstairs and found only a bench and stand? No keyboard? There must be some way to fix this, she thought. Maybe an online retailer could deliver a keyboard by morning. Maybe she could sneak out to a store if one was still open. She looked into both options, but no luck. Now desperate, Shoemaker posted in a neighborhood Facebook group. "I'm about to cry," she wrote, explaining the situation. "I'm so devastated this will ruin her Christmas." Andy Spencer, who lives 5 miles from Shoemaker, was crawling into bed just before 2 a.m. when he saw her plea. "Any parent would be in a panic," Spencer says. "I wouldn't want anyone who believes in the magic of Christmas to be disappointed." He thought of the keyboard his wife had gotten for their daughter, Hallie, 2 years earlier. They still had it, and honestly, Hallie had hardly played it at all. Spencer got out of bed and headed down the hall to see whether Hallie was awake. She and her brother Justin, both home from college, were still up. When their dad told them what was going on, they were eager to help. Hallie's keyboard looked new and had the power cord and AC adapter that went with it. Plus, it had 61 full-size keys and would fit perfectly on the stand that Shoemaker had. "My daughter was more than willing to give up the keyboard, and my son was like, 'We've got to do this,'" Spencer says. So we typed a message to Shoemaker. "Where do you live? We have a smaller keyboard that we could part with." Reading the message, Shoemaker couldn't believe how quickly her luck had turned. "The fact that he didn't know me at all. Not many people are like that nowadays," she says. The two messaged back and forth, agreeing to meet at a grocery store across the street from Shoemaker's home. "It was late and kind of foggy," she says. "I was like, this is either going to end up on the ID channel, the Investigation Discovery channel, which features true crime programming, or the Hallmark channel." Within a few minutes, the Spencers pulled in, all three of them. There was no way Hallie and Justin were going to miss this. Together, they loaded the keyboard into Shoemaker's car. "What do you want for it?" Shoemaker asked, figuring she'd send them some money. "No, seriously, it's free," Spencer replied. All he wanted, he told her, was a photo of a happy Aubrey on Christmas morning. "Unless, maybe..." We all joked together that if she ended up being the next Taylor Swift, "I want a shout-out," he says. Just a few hours later, Aubrey woke up and scampered into the living room. "Mom," she explained when she saw the keyboard. She immediately began tickling the keys, and her face lit up like the Christmas tree beside her as those first few notes emerged. Later that day, Shoemaker messaged Spencer to say thanks once again and to tell him that Aubrey was so engrossed with her new keyboard, she had several presents and a stocking still unopened. He showed the message to Hallie and Justin. "We all had a good chuckle over it," says Spencer. What had been such a little thing for them meant everything to someone else. Aubrey practices on her keyboard almost every day, her mother standing behind her and teaching her classics like Mary Had a Little Lamb and Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. It's often the first thing she wants to do in the morning, hopping on and off the bench throughout the day. I have never seen something keep a four-year-old's attention like this keyboard, Shoemaker texted to Spencer months later. I don't think there's anything that could possibly top it, Shoemaker says. Maybe if I got her a grand piano, but I'd probably have to get a new place for that. Jokes aside, the whole experience of the night had Shoemaker believing in Christmas magic. It didn't hit me until I got home, she says. I literally just met Santa Claus, like, in real life. That was actually him, and he came with elves and everything. That was Secret Santa Saves the Day by Caroline Fanning. And finally, a very short stocking stuffer piece, It Was in the Bag. Mary Kate Borner and Juliana Laporte of Chicago have been friends since high school. Every year, they do a Secret Santa gift exchange with a few other pals. Last year, Borner drew Laporte's name. Knowing that her friend was reeling from the recent loss of her mom, Borner had an idea. Laporte had posted on Instagram a note her mom had written to her, so Borner bought her a bag and sewed a replica of that note into it. I wanted to give her something that was personal and had touches of her mom that she could carry with her everywhere, Borner told People. Laporte loves her gift and the person who gave it to her. This has just really showed how meaningful our friendship is, she says. We have run out of time for today's episode. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.